Welcome to Clearly Quaker, an ongoing series of podcasts by Salem Quarterly Meeting, part of the Religious Society of Friends. Salem Quarterly Meeting is an association of seven Southern New Jersey Quaker meetings within Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. This podcast features Norval Rees, author of Private Quaker, Public Quaker, speaking about the revitalization of Quaker meetings at Salem Quarterly Meeting on Sunday, March 12th, in the Woodstown Friends Meeting House. Rees is a member of the Newtown Friends Meeting in Pennsylvania. He has served as clerk of the meeting, chair of the Board of Advisors of the Earlham School of Religion, founding board member of C-SPAN, and currently serves on the boards of Friends Fiduciary Corporation, Haverford College, George School, the David Library of the American Revolution, and is a member of the American Friends Service Committee's Centennial Campaign Leadership Committee. Rees served in India from 1960 to 62 with the American Friends Service Committee, leading seminars and work camps for students at the University of Delhi.
Well, friends, I'm very pleased to be here on such a beautiful morning. It's welcome to spring. I know it's spring because we went to the flower show in Philadelphia this weekend. And how many people have been there? Oh, good. I encourage you to go. It's all about Holland. So therefore, you know, it's about wooden shoes and bicycles and tulips and sustainability. If you go by the Bartlett tree exhibit, they'll give you a little tree to take home and plant to help sustain the planet. So I hope today we can, metaphorically at least, take home a Quaker tree to plant in our Quaker meetings to sustain our Quaker meetings and make them available and thriving and beautiful and big and strong for future generations. So I'm here today to talk a little bit about my journey from being a private Quaker to becoming a public Quaker and to tell a few stories and to have a discussion and to... I'm going to talk about some numbers. I know some Quakers don't like to talk about numbers. It seems like it's a kind of diminishing of things. It's qualitative instead of quantitative, or quantitative instead of qualitative. So, but I think we need to look at numbers. We need to be factual, and we're going to need to take a hard look at really where we are as a society. The numbers aren't particularly pretty. But I hope what we take away today is not any kind of doom and gloom, but a spirit of revitalizing, a commitment to helping revitalize our Quaker meetings, take away a new focus. Taking care of what we've been given and paying it forward for future generations. You know, paying it forward is really a term I think is attributed to Ben Franklin, who somebody once sent me a letter, a friend of his, and said, I'd like to borrow some money. And Ben Franklin thought about it. He was a good man, and he just was in need. And so Ben sent him a letter and said, I will loan you the money that you need. You're a good man, and I'm sure in good time you will be able to pay it back. But I don't want you to pay it back to me. I want you to give it to some other good and deserving person. I want you to pay it forward. So it's a wonderful concept, which I'm very fond of. Why are we even talking about this? Well, because membership in the Society of Friends is on the decline. That's probably not news to anybody. It's not the only organized religion in the United States that's on the decline, if you can call Quakers organized. They all are. But we're still on the decline, and we need to do something to reverse the tide if we're going to again, start growing again, as we once did. If we believe it's important to the Quaker faith, Quaker ideals and Quaker values, if we think they should continue to play a role in our society, I think we have to focus on how do we revitalize our Quaker meetings, all of them. So I'm very happy to be here in the Salem Quarter today. How we revitalize our meetings, I think, is not some kind of rocket science or some kind of big mystery. It's mostly about the will to change what we're doing and the discipline to do something differently. It's not particularly easy, but it's a commitment we have to be willing to make in order to make that change. So what does revitalizing mean anyway? What does it involve? Can we revitalize our meeting? Should we? Could we? Should we? Well, I've had an interesting journey along this path myself. I've changed my own opinions on the subject. Maybe that's why I'm here, I don't know. But I've been fortunate to be associated with the Quaker meeting in Newtown that's experienced strong growth and vitality while I've been a member of the last 35 years. So the term revitalization, I think, is a good one for us Quaker folk. Implies that once we were more vital, that's true. It implies that there were some good old days to which we can return or at least think about, and there are. But it's also, to me, it's about paying it forward. So I think of revitalization as simply being a good steward. We all heard about stewardship. Every religion, I think, in the universe has a concept of stewardship. I used to think about stewardship, like many people, as giving money, talent, time to your meeting, contributing. But now I think of it more in terms of preserving and protecting, revitalizing, investing, being stewards of the world around us, of our values, to our form of government, to our natural environment, to our Quaker meetings. Not just preserving these, conservation if you will, but revitalizing them, enabling them to prosper in the years ahead for future generations. So in the business world where I come from, there's a saying that if you're not growing, you're dying. That's pretty blunt. But there's some truth in that. We can't sit on our past accomplishments as Quakers, though there are many, and they're impressive. We've been around for 360 years, and many of us assume that Quakers will always be around, but I, for one, think we can no longer take that for granted. We Quakers are prone to think, I think, more in terms of helping other people, of righting wrongs in our society at large, of feeding the hungry, trying to prevent the next war, of equal opportunities for all. We tend to think about service, what we can do for other people, as we should, and don't think about ourselves. I think that's all well and good. To think about ourselves seems somehow sort of self-indulgent or self-promotional or marketing, even, the dreaded M word. There, I said it, and the walls didn't come tumbling down yet. So I'm going to suggest this morning that we need to think about ourselves. And I'm going to make some specific recommendations about how to change. I don't do this as a theologian, though I studied theology. I don't do it as a social activist, though I have been one. And I don't do it as a historian, though I'm a bit of a history buff. But I do it as a pragmatist from the bottom line world of politics, corporate America, but one who loves the Religious Society of Friends. So my comments are in four parts. A review of some personal experiences to indicate how I became a public Quaker. A look at the perception of religion today in this country. A candid, hard look at the Religious Society of Friends, and some suggestions about what we might do to revitalize our local meetings. And I'll make some specific suggestions. If they're relevant, fine. If they're not, just discard them, go on to the next. So my family spends our summers on Cape Cod. And down the beach from our house is an old boathouse, the doctor's boathouse. Dr. Rogers is a kind of a gruff old man, but he had a heart of gold. So all the kids loved Dr. Rogers, and they loved the boathouse. It was mysterious. It was old. It had everything imaginable inside it. But there were rules to the doctor's boathouse. You had to be invited in. You couldn't just go in. Second, if you're really good, the doctor might let you borrow a tool to fix a broken toy or a fishing rod or some other thing. He had the most tools in the universe. And three, if you borrowed a tool, you had to bring it back and return it in better shape than when you borrowed it. Had to, or you might not be invited back to the doctor's boathouse, which would be a terrible, terrible thing. So the doctor's boathouse and its contents were always in very good condition because everybody wanted to be invited back. So I tend to think of the Religious Society of Friends as being the doctor's boathouse, our doctor's boathouse. It's a magnificent, mysterious place with everything we need. And all of us who share it have met the doctor's first two rules. We've been allowed in. We've all borrowed tools from time to time. We have benefited from being a member of our Quaker meeting. But what about the doctor's third point? Are we leaving our Quaker meetings in better shape than when we found them? Well, whenever I'm challenged to leave things in better shape or to do better, I think about some of the basic tenets of Quakers. Three radical theological assumptions. These are radical 350 years ago. They're still radical. One, all people are equal in the eyes of God and have the light within. Just think about that in today's context. Respecting all people, valuing all people equally in the eyes of God. Second, continued revelation is possible of understanding more about God and of our life here on earth than we now know. So it implies a little humility and the possibility that we will know more in the future. There's not no one laid down a set of creeds and said, this is it, and you believe or you don't believe. It's continuing revelation. It's an open book, so it requires a little humility going forward. And three, the perfectibility of man. Whoa, that's a pretty big one too. The concept that we can become better people, that all people can become better people, that they can improve, they can change their behavior, they can change their attitudes, their thoughts towards other people and the world around us. Well, this is still radical, and there's still these three basic radical Quaker concepts that have kind of punctuated my improbable life and multiple careers. So I want to say about why I became a public Quaker. This is not a natural and easy thing for me. I grew up in a wonderful protected Quaker cocoon. How many here were lifelong Quakers and grew up in little Quaker cocoons? It's a wonderful way to grow up, and every kid ought to grow up this way. I lived in Plainfield, Indiana, a small town in the Midwest, founded by Quakers who migrated to the Midwest from places like New Jersey and Pennsylvania to follow the good farmland out there. And I stretched my intellectual and social world in college and my spiritual and theological world in divinity school. And 2 years in India that I spent with the American Friends Service Committee and the British Friends Service Council. So my beliefs were refined and tempered, if you will, and case-hardened by travel and by my professional life. As a social and political activist in the 60s, as a state government employee in the 70s, as a corporate executive in marketing and finance in the 80s, and an international cable television entrepreneur in the 90s. Well, Aristotle said there are three phases to one's life. The first phase should be devoted to the best education possible. The second should be devoted to working and raising a family. And the third to serving society. Well, I sort of did that, but I managed to convolute my professional career into at least three different three different careers, one in service work with the Quakers, one in government and politics and one in cable TV. So I want to just tell you a little bit more about why. Well, let me mention a couple of the things that I did. When I was in India, I worked with the as assistant director of the Quaker Center there to work with students at the University of Delhi. We had an international seminar, met every Saturday, and the Quakers were greatly respected in India because the British friends supported Gandhi in the Quit India movement. So the Quakers were held in great esteem in India, as they are in many parts of the world, most parts of the world. So I had the Prime Minister Nehru came to talk to my kids for an hour and a half and things like that. So it was a great experience, and we had work camps around in Indian villages and Tibetan work camps and Tibetan refugee camps and so on. So when I finished, I cashed in my ticket home because I wanted to see some more of the world and hitchhiked home, basically, and climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, went down the Nile on a barge and things like that, and got into the Soviet Union. This was way back in the early 60s when Americans weren't allowed, but the Russians had told the Swiss group sponsoring the European 20 students from Europe that were coming in that if you want to bring in one or two American Europeans, wink, wink, it'll be all right. So I got in as an American European and spent 6 weeks there. But after that, I came back to the States, and I was so against what I learned about the American presence in Vietnam that I really was a full-time activist in the 60s against the Vietnam War and for civil rights. And I marched with King in Washington and Selma, met him a couple of times, and so on and so forth, and got involved in politics. So when you're in politics, particularly, you know, I learned a lot about how things function. I mean, it puts a huge magnifying glass on ordinary activities, as we know, more and more so today because of the internet and so on and so forth. But all this time, I was a private Quaker. It's not that I didn't tell people I was a Quaker. I did, but I just left it there. I was too involved in other activities. How many of you have ever taken part in a protest march? Well, look at that. That's pretty good. Why? Why did you do it? Anybody? Yeah. Okay. Leading to do what? Yeah, go ahead.
To be an active participant in democracy, to make sure that my social concerns are felt.
Okay.
Partly because at the time, which was your time more or less, it was an alternative to the very noisy SDS. It was a very Quaker.
Okay.
Then we did, and we did it in silence.
Did anybody want to change anything? Is that partly why you're marching?
The world, sure. But we certainly wanted to educate.
I marched because of several things. I was against something like the war in Vietnam. I was for something which is something better. I was trying to influence people in elective office, people who were making the decisions, trying to change their minds. And I was trying to attract thousands of other people to join me to make a point. So I was purposely calling attention to myself and the march and the group for some other purpose, I mean, to try to change things. But I was trying to influence the media, yes, and the public, yes, and government officials. But I mentioned the huge magnifying glass it puts on events when you're doing something like that. Well, here's what I learned. One, that in order to be successful, one has to be, first, very well organized, and second, focused in one's message. Third, simple and direct in one's comments for media. You have to be simple. So you, Quakers ought to understand this, but we really don't so much. So we can be understood. And four, you have to be self-promotional. If you're a candidate running for office, which I was, you have to do that if you want to try to influence people to think that you would provide a better option, say, to ending the war in Vietnam, which was my main concern when I ran for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania as a candidate in the Democratic primary, than others who were supporting the war. And five, you have to be aware that your language and your style and your manner is important. That's why we had thousands of students who were clean for Gene, for Eugene McCarthy, when I ran his Pennsylvania campaign and was national director, head of his national schedule in advance. And it helped because we convinced a lot more people. We weren't just a ragtag mob. We were, you know, quote, respectable students. So and the last point is I learned you have to be patient when delivering one's message to someone. You have to realize that some people's perception of what is true might be more important to them than the truth itself. So sometimes we have to tread lightly. Well, this was, you know, these are new lessons for a Quaker kid to learn. But in politics and in government, in business, I readily use strategic planning, prioritizing goals, advertising, promotion, and fundraising to get my message across. I did this all the time, routinely. Whether the goal was for civil rights or to end the war in Vietnam, to double the size of our company, or to bring uncensored news to people in a communist country, like in Poland, which I did. So I was very comfortable during this period in keeping my Quakerism private to myself, separate from my worldly activities. The thought never occurred to me that what I was doing professionally would have any application to my religious faith or to my Quaker meeting or to the religious side of Friends. It did occur to Tom Jevons, who was then General Secretary of the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. We were having lunch one day and he said, well, you know, we're talking about all this. And he said, well, Norville, if you want to use these skills for politics and business, why not for your Quaker beliefs? Are they less important? Good question. Good question for all of us. We each have skills, special skills we can bring. We're not all equal in terms of skills and education and so on and so forth. We know that. We're equal in value in the eyes of God. But in terms of ability and skills, we're educated in different ways. But we each have skills and talent we can bring to our Quaker meetings and apply them. And my message is that I think we're going to have to start applying them more energetically than we have in the past if we want to continue as a robust religious society of Friends. So, why am I saying this? Public opinion polls by Pew Research for the last 15 or 20 years have showed that all over the country, organized religion is on the decline. People are opting out, but they're considering themselves to be more spiritual than religious. They seem to be objecting to a top-down hierarchy with a creedal commitment and so on. They're turning away from organized religion, apparently, to look for something more individually based, follow their insights instead of those of the church. Does this sound familiar? It should to Quakers. And this should be good news for us. I mean, it should be very good news for an independent thinking, individually oriented group like the Quakers. But our numbers are also on the decline. And you know, some Quakers like to take comfort that we're small in numbers, but we're big in influence, big in impact. And that's absolutely true. Now, what counts is quality, not quantity. But we've been the forefront historically on many things. I don't have to tell friends that, but just to mention a few, we helped launch the Industrial Revolution back in the 17th, 18th centuries by having fixed prices and treating employees fairly. And people found out that Quakers trusted each other, and therefore they set a norm, if you will, and it spread throughout British society that, you know, you could trust the Quakers, so why not have fixed prices? Our whole capitalism is based on trust, really. And if you don't have that, then you have an incredible mess. So we actually given credit by some historians of launching the Industrial Revolution, for whatever that means to you. But I want to say a word about William Penn, because I think he doesn't get enough credit historically in this country. But he helped launch American-style democracy by establishing his whole experiment in Pennsylvania based on a staggering number of firsts. I mean, think about these things that William Penn did in Pennsylvania and his so on. Freedom of religion, women's rights, limited power of government, private property, free enterprise, free press, a humane penal code, and the right to trial by jury. I mean, he was the guy who was on the forefront of all these things. So it's little wonder that Thomas Jefferson called him, William Penn, quote, the greatest lawgiver the world has ever known. Our own William Penn. So I won't get into all the other, well, I have to mention one other thing here. You know, we know about the Quakers and being the first religious group to oppose slavery and so on, and you know, strong in the civil rights and whatever. But how many of you know that the new $20 bill is going to have, on the flip side, 5 women? So how many people know how many Quakers are among those 5? 3, absolutely right. 3 Quakers among the 5 women recognized in this country for contributing to democracy and suffrage and so on? 3 out of 5, that's pretty good for a little group. It's very good. Susan B. Anthony, Alice Paul, and? Lucretia Mott. You got it. So, yes, a small group can have a big impact, and we have had a big impact historically, but now we're looking to the future. I used to chair the board of the Earlham School of Religion, the advisory board. And we did a study in 2005 called the Comprehensive Case for Support for the School Religion. But it had some sobering statistics about Quakers. And I just want to mention those because that's why we're here. Over the past 30 years, membership in North American yearly meetings of the Religious Society Friends has dropped precipitously. It's dropped by 23.5%. And that's a lot. I mean, any business would have to think, you know, what's going on? And the report continues. This is done in 2005. It's a long time ago. Quote, if these downward trends in our society's membership were to continue unchecked, American Quakers would become extinct sometime late in the 21st century. Yoo-hoo, that's this century. And the Friends World Committee for consultation doesn't help very much either. It doesn't give us any more comfort. Their numbers say that they continue on from that time period, from 2002 on to 2012. So adding all these together, we continued to lose membership. And we're down now, they say, to 77,000 in this country. But We have lost, over the 50-year period, 43,000 Quakers in membership. Okay, how about Philadelphia Unity Meeting? Well, we're doing a little bit better, but not much. If it's better to not decline by so much, I think that is better. But it's not much better, not much comfort here. From 1990 to 2015, that's the last year we have complete data for, our membership has dropped from 12,837 to 10,615. 17% drop in 25 years. Right here in the middle of Quakerdom of the universe in the Philadelphia, greater Philadelphia area. Now, for example, from 2014 to 15, membership improved in only 6 quarterly meetings in the year to meeting. It declined in 6, including our quarter here, Salem, and it was flat in 1. The overall Philadelphia Yearly Meeting net membership loss in that 1 year was 48, which doesn't sound like a lot, but if you keep doing that every year, you know, it's not good news. So we have 103 monthly meetings in Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. And since 2004, 60% of our monthly meetings have lost membership. 60%. But some have not. Now we get to some better news, I hope. Some are growing, including my hometown meeting in Newtown. And since I know most about that one, I'm gonna talk about it. So I hope you're not offended by me talking about my own meeting. But it's not the only one that's growing, but it's one that's been doing very well. So in the last 20 years, it's grown from 210 to 320. It's up by 52%. But more about that later. I used to have a consulting company, Keen Reese Associates, and we did valuations of media properties, TV stations, cable television companies, network programs like HBO and so on and so forth. And we did them for banks or the IRS or private equity firms, people who wanted to consider, who were considering investing in them or buying the entire companies. So we analyzed their strengths and weaknesses and wrote an opinion on it that had to stand up in court if necessary. So I was thinking about this, and if my company were evaluating Quakerism today, what would we say? My summary might read something like this. Dynamic, aggressive, history-altering past performance, currently holds some valuable real estate. That's a beautiful building here, by the way. It is a wonderful meeting house. Perception of Quakers historically is of high quality, integrity, prudence, trust, and dependability. Little knowledge or understanding by general public of current Quakers, who seem to have no plans for growth or expansion. In short, investing in Quakers today would involve a strong, historic brand name with considerable risk, a good undervalued entity, but a risky venture. So I asked my good friend John Spears. Some people here probably know John Spears. He's a member of Princeton Meeting. But John is one of the 4 managing directors of Tweedy Browne, a $17 or $18 billion investment fund. So I asked him the same question, if he would invest in Quakers if they were listed on the stock exchange. Now here's what John said. If it were a public company, no. I do not think I would buy it. I think the Quaker brand and the old classic Quaker product is a great brand, a great niche product that used to have wider appeal. But it has been mismanaged, mispackaged, mismarketed, undermarketed, and the numbers on membership and attendance and financial support over the last few decades show that our Quaker product is losing market share and financial support. The message, the benefit to people of Quakerism, the benefit to people about Quakerism is generally not selling well in competition with other religions. Then John goes on to say, but I think the Religious Society of Friends has turnaround potential. Some of the franchises of the Religious Society Friends local meetings have been competing well, offering a product that appeals to people that is gaining market share. The organization has speculative potential over the long run. For that turnaround to occur, there needs to be significant adaptation of best practices at the local level. It's not a slam dunk at all that this will happen given the corporate culture. Did I say that John Spears is one of the best analysts on Wall Street? So it's worth listening to John, which I do. But lest we despair, I want to tell you about a young man, Ross Hennessy, who set aside his career path to become a college professor to work for Quaker Voluntary Service. How many people know about Quaker Voluntary Service? Good, we all should know about it. This is started by a 30-something young lady named Christina Repoli. A few years ago, it gives people in their right out of college an opportunity to work for not-for-profit, to live together, to worship together, and to work for very little money. I think they get paid $15,000 a year by the not-for-profit they're working for. She thought Quakers ought to have some kind of a service project with so young people could both serve, work in a not-for-profit, and learn more about Quakerism in the process. I told her we didn't need another Quaker organization, and by the end of lunch, she convinced me and I was contributing money to her. She's a very competent young lady. And they now have offices in Atlanta, Philadelphia, Portland, Oregon, Boston. And they're doing a very good job of outreach, in my judgment. Quaker outreach. Marketing, they do that. Revitalization, yeah, they're doing that. So here's what Ross said, this young man running the Philadelphia operation. I have on more than one occasion been told I'm part of a dying religion. My non-Quaker friends are baffled by why I spend so much time and energy with you. They don't get it. Neither the silence nor the tired debates we circle around and around long after they have ceased being relevant. Our congregations are aging. And while we may be great listeners, we are terrible at communicating the things that matter most to us. I'm going to read that again. While we're great listeners, we are terrible at communicating things that matter most to us. This is a young guy who just joined the Quakers. Who among us is laying the plans for Quaker utopias? Who are the innovators who are speaking relevant truth and organizing us into communities that will not only survive, but thrive, that will change the world to be more just, more peaceful, and more equitable? So Ross continues to say, Quakers for the 21st century needs a panoply, a bouquet of individuals and organizations, old and new, that move us forward. Rufus Jones' idea, we were just talking about Rufus Jones a while ago, Rufus Jones' idea of continuing revelation freed Quakers to pursue spirit beyond the confines of tradition or text. But more than that, this idea also contains within it both the promise and a threat. It is the promise that each generation which inherits this ongoing story acts as midwife to an unfolding of truth lived out. But if we ever let this generational pact be broken, truth will arrive to us stillborn. This is why I have thrown my lot in with you peculiar people. I like that. This is why I am a Quaker. It is a faith commitment that the greatness of our community is yet to come, that we still remain a great people to be gathered. I don't know about you, friends, but I find that flat out inspiring. So these descriptions are anecdotal, and they come from different perspectives, but they say pretty much the same thing about the Society of Friends. The Society of Friends is not in great shape at the moment. We have an incredibly inspiring history with an impact on society way out of proportion to our numbers. And there are some signs of new vitality, and we have great potential if we act on it. So returning to John Spears' hypothetical analysis of Quakers, today we, the Quakers, we're not the potential investors John was talking about. We are the investors. We're the owners. We are the stewards. Revitalization is up to us. If we can't do it, it won't be done. So what should we be doing? Well, I'm going to mention a few things. There's some handouts up here that people can pick up afterwards. Some are just publicity to tell you how Newtown Meeting gets in the papers every week and people walking off the street. And we've had people join meeting because of that. It's not self-promotional. It's just sharing information with people, letting them know we exist and what's going on. And there's some other sheets up here about which you can pick up afterwards too. And one is just the blue sheet is just 5 points on how to become a Quaker that we leave on our information table. Because it is always astounding to me how many people can be attending for years and not know how to join. And you know, just it's to them it's a mystery how people become a member of the Quakers. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how to become active stewards. I'm keeping an eye on the clock because I don't want to go over. We know that our membership is aging and we're dropping in numbers, but just to refer you to go back to Cape Cod for a moment, how many people in here are sailors? We must have some sailors because we're down here near the coast and whatever. Well, there's a saying among sailors, you know, if you're racing a sailboat and you're not doing well, change something. Do something different, you know? So what are the variables? The speed and direction of the wind, the speed and direction of the tide, the set of the sails, the rudder, where the weight is distributed in the boat. All of these things are factors that could determine how fast you're going, how quickly you can reach your goal. So if we Quakers want to do better, we may have to change something. I also love that old adage that says, we cannot direct the wind, but we can adjust our sails. That's pretty good. You don't have to be a sailor to get that. So I'm going to skip along here to say that the three things I think we have to do are change the way we do things, make sure that we have a big tent, an open door to everyone, whether they're whoever they are, whatever they are. We had a couple of kids who attended Newtown Meeting who, in the last 5 years, who've gone to West Point. And that's kind of shocking to some people. And the first chap went to West Point, and the graduating senior stood up and said where they were going to go from George School, and he said, well, I'm going. I'm sad to say this, but I'm going to West Point because I think we need good people in our military. Well, good for you, Brian. But we have to accept, and we totally accept him and support his decision. So we have to accept all kinds of people. We have to be a big tent with a welcome mat and an open door. And then we have to get outside the tent to share our beliefs with other people in our communities. George Fox, of course, shared his beliefs. He was not a private Quaker. I mean, he was marching, walking through the snow barefooted, right? Shouting, woe to the bloody city of Litchfield. And he walked into an Anglican church and walked down in the middle of the sermon down the aisle and said, you know, come down, thou great deceiver, speaking to the Anglican priest. I mean, no wonder he's locked up for a few times, you know. But he was a public Quaker. He also, just imagine this, he was probably, as it were, preaching for maybe 45 years. And during that time, his followers became known as the Religious Society of Friends. But when he died, there were like 50,000 of them. 50,000! Because he felt compelled to share his beliefs with other people. Of course, you know, I don't know how many went to, at least 6,000-7,000 went to prison for their beliefs because there was only one legal church in England at the time. So we were not only rabble-rousers, but illegal. by trying to be Quakers. Well, let me just mention a few points here, and you can find more things on the handouts. There's some Quaker, some of our umbrella Quaker organizations, I'm going to call them umbrella, are actually doing a rather remarkable job that we might not even know about. But first, one that's just happening by itself. I'm told by a marketing professional in our meeting that the word Quakers or Quaker receives an average of 27,000 hits per month on Google. 27,000. Now, this is not all Quakers, I'm quite sure. But we don't know who these people are, but that's a lot of hits. Friends Journal. You all get Friends Journal. And do you see their digital stuff, and you see the Quaker speak and so on? Well, Friends Journal has launched itself into the digital age, and I think into social media and so on quite well. They now reach, with their print digital readership and Quaker speak YouTube, 800,000 people a year in over 200 countries and territories. I mean, that's huge, and that's just in the last, that's from a modest 150,000 or something, maybe 5 years ago. And keep in mind, in Philadelphia, the historic Fourth and R Street Meeting House still has, 30,000 people going through visitors every year. And we've actually had people join Newtown Meeting, having had their first contact with Quakers at Fourth and R Street as a tourist. So they're doing the kind of an umbrella job, but the only people who can actually accept a member are local meetings, the folks in this room. So we're the ones who have to do the rest of the job. I think sometimes Quakers, in our eagerness not to seem to be proselytizing, let people not fall through the cracks, but we don't respond to people as openly as we should. We're denying people maybe something that might become very special in their lives. I'm haunted by the story of a man in Newtown. We thought we did a pretty good job, but a guy came to the meeting several years ago, and he said, first meeting, one meeting for worship. And afterwards, during coffee, he said, "This is my first meeting for worship. I want to join. I'm a Quaker. I think I'm a Quaker. I want to join. One meeting for worship." And after I got over my shock, he said, I've lived in Newtown for 17 years, and I never knew you existed." Well, friends, if we're really doing our job, that just shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen. Another attender told, his brother told me that we're talking about his brother coming to meeting. And he did some work for the meeting, some valuation work. He was a real estate appraiser. And he wouldn't take any pay for it. I said, "Well, no, it's, I want to pay for it. We'd like to pay you for it." And he said, "No, I can't possibly." He said, "This meeting is the most important thing in my brother's life. It has saved his life, so I won't take any payment." I mean, which I had no idea that, it was that important to that person. But so we have to reach out and make sure that we're doing everything we can to let people know we're here. We did a survey of our meeting to find out if we're doing a good job. And that I'd recommend that. Find out how people heard about the meeting, what they think about the quality of the meeting for worship. I'll share that survey if you want, or maybe Jared, did I send it to you, wherever Jared is? Did I send that to you, a copy of the survey? If I didn't send that survey, I can do that. But it's a good thing to find out. I believe in surveys, not because they're the arbiter of truth or whatever, but they let people let you know what people are thinking. Gives everyone a chance to say what they're thinking. So I'd recommend that. We found out some things that we changed as a result of that. So I want to wrap it up by saying just some specific points on three areas: governance, and inreach, and outreach. Because I think all are relevant to attracting new people to meeting. Governance, because you know, we just have to make sure that we're doing well in governing our own meetings. We're taking care of our own business. And I'm kind of a nut on this, I suppose, but we don't always get the best people for jobs when we ask for volunteers, open volunteers. It's wonderful. It's a quick, early thing to do. But sometimes, you know, it's good to pick your most skilled people to put in the most skilled positions. It's good to have people understand something about finance and finance, and people understand something about buildings and grounds on the Buildings and Grounds Committee. So we need to make sure we pick skilled people and run it as well as we can. We need to delegate authority more than we do a lot of Quaker meetings. We don't need committees for everything. If somebody does well in a certain skill, give them the job and let them run with it. Unless it needs corporate consideration, you know, just, you know, let them do it. We need to trust people to do a job. I love the sunset rules. I think we should look at all of our committees occasionally. I think we should have term limits. It's a very good way to change leadership and get new ideas and revitalize meetings to 2-year terms, maybe for clerks, 3 years for people on committees, or 3-year terms, the three consecutive years, maybe, yeah, terms. Manage your money. I usually say this, but I don't think I have to say it to this group because I checked before I came, and most of the meetings here are invested in Friends Fiduciary Corporation, so I think you're pretty savvy people. I happen to be on that board. But Friends Fiduciary, in case you don't know, is doing a very good job. It's not your old Friends Fiduciary of 10 or 15 years ago. It's a new team, and they're highly professional, and they're skilled. And I just want to make, I checked the numbers before I came over. From January 31, 2016 to January 31, 2017, 12 months. The main fund, the consolidated fund's up 13.74%. The fossil fuel free green fund is up 12.45%. The Quaker index fund is up 18.96%. Not bad. So if you're not investing your money there, I recommend you take a look at it. So when we go to inreach and outreach, let me just mention a couple things, and most of this you'll find up here on the bench, and I hope you'll pick up papers afterwards. I like your name tags out here. We found out in Newtown Meeting that I think you should all have name tags. Attenders, new people, appreciate it, especially. And we found we have plastic ones or clip ones that look kind of professional like you do out here. Attenders, we found if they've been there 3 or 4 times and we ask them if they'd like to have a name tag, it's like a first step towards membership or something. They really appreciate it. Kids too. I mean, it's kind of a big deal. It surprised me because I was never in favor of name tags. I thought they were tacky and so on and so forth. But it turns out to be very important. So if your meetings don't have kind of professional looking name tags, I recommend it. And I just want to mention again that we need to invite attenders to join things. We need to ask them if they'd like to serve on a committee. They can go on ex officio or whatever if necessary, but they need to be invited to things. Social events are terribly important. We have quite a few friendly eats, dinner parties. We have somebody invites attenders to a dinner at their house on a monthly basis, new attenders. We need to invite them to join meeting. I mentioned this before, but we just had a person who has been coming now for about 6 months, every single Sunday helping out with the kids' classes. And she said, my wife was talking to her actually, and she said that, well, she had attended Quaker meetings for 14 years at 2 other places. And Ann said, well, have you ever thought about joining? She said, no. She said, actually I did, but no one ever asked me. And she said, well, would you like to consider joining? He said, yeah, I would. 14 years, that's too long, friends. You know, but that's, there's a difference between attending and joining. People have told me this, and I believe it. It's sort of the difference between renting a house and owning a house. Renting a house, you can kind of walk away from it. But if you own it, you know, it's a little different matter. So we have to, you know, we should encourage friends to join. Now, finally, I'm just going to mention one other thing. How many people know about World Quaker Day? Ah, breaks my heart. It's pretty new. But the World Quaker Day this year is going to be October the 1st. Friends World Committee, internationally, for consultation established the day. Some of us encouraged them to do this a couple years ago. It's a day when you just celebrate being a Quaker. Have some public event and invite people in from the public. Put it in the newspaper. You're celebrating World Quaker Day. You're going to have tea and somebody will tell about their spiritual journey or tell about people who grew up Quakers that you never knew, like James Michener and James Dean or Daniel Boone. Did you all know that? They all grew up as Quakers. And talk about some of the historic people. But it's a wonderful way to open your doors and to celebrate. We need to celebrate being Quakers. And in closing, I just want to mention the Glasgow meeting in Scotland that had a Quaker Day, a Quaker Week in England. But and on the front page of the Glasgow paper, and the paper said, the Glasgow Library Scheme was held where they had a human library at the meeting house on Saturday where visitors could borrow a Quaker for 40 minutes for a chat and a cup of coffee. And you could borrow all kinds of Quakers, business Quaker, educator Quaker, government Quaker. Isn't that wonderful? I love that. In closing, I'm just going to read one of my favorite quotes from George Fox. George Fox extolled us to, quote, be patterns. Be examples in all countries, places, islands, nations, wherever you go, so that your courage in life may preach among all sorts of people and to them. Then you will come to walk cheerfully over the world, answering that of God in every one. To me, that's good stewardship. That's revitalization. Thank you, friends.
Thank you for listening to Clearly Quaker. We hope you have found this podcast thought-provoking. If you have questions or comments, or would like to learn more about South Jersey Quakers, reach us at salemquarter.net.